Okay, let's unpack this. Because usually, when we talk about a physical measurement, especially in science, there's this base level expectation of precision, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like engineering. If you are building a house, you measure the foundation, you pour the concrete, and the architect just points to the blueprint and says, "There it is. That's reality."
Right. It's a very comforting framework. I mean, we desperately want the physical world to be solid,
Yeah,
to
exactly.
be strictly measurable, and, most importantly, to be made of distinct, visible building blocks that we can just put in a box and label.
Right, brick or not brick, it's clean. But then you step into the world of modern theoretical physics and specifically cosmology,
Oh boy, yeah.
right? And suddenly that beautiful, clean blueprint is completely unreadable. I mean, if you're listening to this right now and you aren't deeply entrenched in physics, you might assume we have a pretty good handle on how the universe works.
Most people do, yeah.
But we are actually looking at a foundational landscape that is, well, to put it bluntly, it's missing.
Entirely missing.
Right. Standard physics right now tells us that 95% of the universe, the stuff supposedly holding entire galaxies together, and the force supposedly pushing empty space apart, is completely, entirely invisible. We call them dark matter and dark energy.
Which is, by definition, the absolute definition of a terminal empirical crisis.
Yeah.
I mean, modern cosmology is effectively operating on a model where the vacuum energy prediction of our best quantum field theory, mind you, is off by 120 orders of magnitude.
Wait, hold on. Let's really emphasize that for a second because I think people hear orders of magnitude and their eyes just kind of glaze over.
They do, yeah. It sounds like academic jargon.
120 orders of magnitude isn't just 120% error. That is a one with 120 zeros behind it.
Right.
I mean, to put that in perspective, the number of atoms in the entire observable universe is only estimated to be around 10 to the 80th power.
Exactly.
So the mathematical discrepancy in our current standard model of physics is vastly larger than the total number of atoms in the universe. That's not a rounding error.
No, it's a catastrophe.
Yeah, a
It
catastrophe.
is objectively the largest mathematical discrepancy in the history of science. It's actually known in physics as the vacuum catastrophe.
Wow.
And yet, the current paradigm largely just accepts it. I mean, we've essentially been acting like this cosmic house we've built is perfectly structurally sound, even though 95% of the bricks are invisible ghost bricks.
Right, bricks that no physical detector on Earth has ever actually been able to isolate or find.
Not once.
Which brings us to our mission today. We are taking a deep dive into a document that claims to fix all of this. We are exploring a mind-bending, universe-altering treatise called The Dodecahedral Proton to CMB Spectrum by David Noel Lynch and a group known as the 3K Collaborative.
That's quite a title.
It is. And I have to admit, when I first started reading this, I was extremely skeptical. I mean, you hear someone say they've solved physics, and you naturally just you put your guard up.
Of course you do. But what's fascinating here, and what really commands our attention, is the sheer scale of the methodological claim they're making. Because this text does not attempt to invent a new, convenient, invisible particle to just patch the mathematical holes in our current theories.
Which is what usually happens.
Exactly. It doesn't ask you to believe in another ghost. Instead, it proposes a pure, non-perturbative, geometric unification.
Stop right there. Non-perturbative. What does that actually mean in plain English? Because that sounds like dense academic jargon.
It is, yeah. But it's a crucial distinction. In standard physics, when math gets too complex to solve exactly, we use something called perturbation theory.
Okay.
You basically guess a simple answer that is close enough, and then you add tiny mathematical corrects perturbations to get closer to reality. It's like guessing the weight of a car
Yeah.
and then adding the weight of the paint and the dust to get a slightly better number.
Okay, that makes sense.
But Lynch's model is non-perturbative, meaning it doesn't guess and correct. It claims to calculate the exact fundamental geometry from the ground up with absolutely no approximations. And it uses this pure geometry to connect the absolute smallest subatomic particle we know, the proton, to the absolute outer edge of the observable universe.
The cosmic horizon.
Exactly.
Bridging the tiniest thing to the largest thing across what the text calls a 61.4 decade scale.
Yes.
So we have a document claiming to unify everything, not with new particles, but with pure geometry. But to understand how this theory redraws the entire universe, we actually have to go back in time.
We do, yeah.
We can't just jump into quantum mechanics. We have to trace the philosophical lineage that brought us to this 120 order of magnitude crisis in the first place. So we're going back 2,500 years.
Right. If we look at the historical progression outlined in the sources, it really frames this as a 2,500-year geometric quest. I mean, before we had particle colliders, we had philosophers trying to decode the blueprint.
Philosophers in togas.
Basically, yeah. It starts around 530 BCE in ancient Greece with Pythagoras.
Right, the guy everyone remembers from high school geometry for the triangle theorem. A squared plus b squared equals c squared.
Exactly. But his real profound contribution to cosmology wasn't actually just triangles. It was acoustic.
Acoustic, like sound.
Yes. Pythagoras discovered that the universe at its core operates on whole number musical ratios. He realized that math and physical vibration are intimately linked.
Okay.
He found that the most stable resonant harmony in nature, right after the basic octave, is what musicians call the perfect fifth. Mathematically, if you look at the string lengths, that is a rational ratio of 3 to 2. Or if you divide it out exactly 1.500.
Okay, I want to make this tangible for you listening. If you pluck a guitar string, it makes a sound. If you press your finger down on that fretboard so that you are now only plucking exactly 2/3 of that string's original length, and you pluck it again, you get a perfect fifth.
Right.
It sounds beautiful. It feels resolved. It's basically the absolute foundation of Western music. So Pythagoras realizes the universe likes this 3.2 ratio. But he also found a massive problem, right?
He did.
Something called the Pythagorean comma, which sounds like a punctuation mark, but it's actually a math problem.
It is a very profound math problem. Pythagoras thought, logically, that if you take that beautiful 3.2 ratio and just keep stacking it, like building a full musical scale by going a fifth up, then another fifth up, and so on, you would expect it to eventually close perfectly into a neat sequence of octaves.
Right, like a perfect closed mathematical loop.
Exactly.
Like walking around a track and ending up exactly on the starting line.
But it doesn't do that. If you mathematically stack 12 perfect fifths, they actually overshoot 7 stacked octaves by a tiny, microscopic, irreducible fraction.
Oh, weird.
That leftover fraction is the Pythagorean comma. It mathematically proved that no power of 3 can ever perfectly equal a power of 2. The circle of fifths, which musicians use all the time, is actually a misnomer.
Wait, really?
Yeah, it is not a closed circle at all. It is an open, continuous spiral.
Okay, so why does a tiny math left over in ancient Greek music theory matter for modern physics? I mean, why are we talking about this?
Because Pythagoras realized that self-referential systems in nature contain an inherent non-zero friction. The universe's math has a built-in inability to perfectly close a loop. It's an engine that can never achieve perfect equilibrium, which means it must keep moving. This concept of mathematical friction is going to become the entire foundation for how the proton gets its mass later in Lynch's theory.
Okay, that makes sense. The universe is a spiral, not a closed circle. So that's Pythagoras around 530 BCE. Then we jump forward about 170 years and we get to Plato. Now, Plato takes this harmonic intuition, but he applies it to 3D geometry.
Yes, specifically in his dialogue, the Timaeus. Plato categorized the regular convex polyhedra, which we now call the Platonic solids.
Right.
These are 3D shapes where every face, edge, and angle is completely identical. There are only 5 of them that can possibly exist in three-dimensional space.
Right. Think of your standard tabletop role-playing dice, the 4-sided pyramid, the 6-sided cube, the 8-sided one, the 20-sided one.
Exactly. And Plato assigned 4 of these physical solids to the classic elements. Fire was the sharp tetrahedron, earth was the stable cube, air was the octahedron, and water was the rolling icosahedron.
But that left a fifth solid.
It did, the dodecahedron.
Right.
A shape made of exactly 12 regular pentagonal faces.
And Plato didn't assign that 12-sided shape to dirt or wind. He reserved it. He said it was used for the embroidering of the constellations. He hypothesized that the dodecahedron was the geometric envelope of the entire cosmos itself.
He envisioned the sky bounded by this dodecahedral geometry. However, according to the treatise we were examining, while Plato was geometrically prophetic, he inadvertently introduced a massive, debilitating philosophical bug into human thinking.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. The authors of the text refer to this as the Platonic pathogen.
The Platonic pathogen? That sounds ominous. What did he do?
Well, Plato treated these mathematical shapes as static, eternal nouns that exist in a perfect, ethereal realm completely outside of physical time. He effectively divorced abstract geometry from active, moving, thermodynamic physics.
I see. So treating the math as a noun instead of a verb. like looking at a map and mistaking it for the actual territory you were walking on.
Exactly.
You start worshiping the concept of a perfect triangle, forgetting that in the real physical world, nothing is ever a perfectly static, frozen triangle. Things are always vibrating, always moving.
Precisely. And this conceptual pathogen treating math as a static, pre-existing container rather than an active physical process, it affected all of science. But let's follow the timeline. We jump forward a long way to 1543, Nicholas Copernicus.
Right, the scientific revolution. Copernicus completely upends everything by proving the Earth isn't the center of the universe. The Earth orbits the sun, heliocentrism.
Yes.
This is obviously a monumental breakthrough for science. We celebrate it. But this text argues that Copernicus actually caused a massive unintended consequence, something called a kinematic dislocation.
It's a fascinating historical critique, really.
Mm-hmm.
By stripping away the old geocentric model, where the Earth was surrounded by these finite, nesting, crystalline spheres of the heavens, Copernicus accidentally birthed the modern idea of space as an infinite, empty, formless void.
Okay, let me try an analogy here to see if I grasp this kinematic dislocation.
Mm.
Imagine Copernicus is trying to remodel humanity's house.
Okay.
He correctly figures out that the living room, the Earth, is not actually the center of the house. That's a great realization. But in the process of proving that, he essentially accidentally tears down all the walls, the ceiling, the foundation, and concludes that the entire world is just an endless, empty, infinite parking lot.
Wow.
Yeah. He threw out the architecture entirely just because he realized we were standing in the wrong room.
That is a remarkably accurate analogy. Science has essentially lived in that infinite parking lot ever since.
Yeah.
We assume space is just, you know, nothingness goes on forever.
Right.
But shortly after Copernicus, Johannes Kepler tried to rebuild the walls. Between 1596 and 1619, Kepler tried to nest Plato's ancient polyhedra, specifically the dodecahedron, directly between the orbits of the planets to map out what he called the music of the spheres.
Wait, Kepler literally tried to build a solar system model out of those giant geometric dice?
He did, yeah. He realized that the planets moved according to very specific mathematical ratios. He found that Saturn and Jupiter's orbits related to a major third musical interval, Earth's related to a semitone, and Mars orbits at that exact 3.2 ratio.
The perfect fifth that Pythagoras found.
Exactly.
Okay, but Kepler was wrong, right? I mean, planets aren't actually rolling around on invisible giant geometric dice. His model didn't perfectly fit the planetary data, which is why he eventually had to formulate his laws of elliptical orbits.
True. Kepler's specific macro application of the solids to planetary orbits was flawed. He was using the right architectural shapes, but at the entirely wrong scale. He saw the harmonies, but he didn't have the subatomic physical models to prove why those harmonies were there. What Lynch's treatise argues is that these ancient discoveries by Pythagoras, Plato, and Kepler weren't just poetic metaphors or blind guesses.
Right.
They were early low-resolution glimpses of the actual geometric instruction set of reality.
They were sensing the shape of the universe, but they didn't have the microlens to see where that shape actually originates.
Exactly.
Which brings us, finally, to the central figure of this deep dive, David Noel Lynch and the 3K Collaborative. To get back to the true foundational architecture of the universe, the text argues that Lynch had to demolish that infinite parking lot concept entirely.
He did.
And you can't just politely sweep away 500 years of established physics. You need a rigorous demolition protocol.
And the text formally refers to this as the Jenga protocol.
The Jenga protocol, like the block stacking game.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Remember that Platonic pathogen we discussed?
Treating mathematical concepts as physical reality.
Right. Modern theoretical physics is completely infected by it. So the Jenga protocol systematically identifies and removes the foundational mathematical blocks that are inherently flawed, forcing the unstable tower of modern physics to collapse so a new one can be built.
Okay.
The two biggest culprits, the most dangerous blocks in the tower, are the zero-dimensional point, which is written mathematically as 0.0 no, and the concept of completion infinity, represented by the Hebrew letter Aleph Null.
Okay, hold on. This is where I start getting a headache. In standard physics right now, we treat fundamental particles, like an electron or a quark, as zero-dimensional points. We treat them as a mathematical dot with absolutely no volume, just a coordinate in space. Why is that such a problem? If it makes the math easier, who cares?
It's a huge problem because it creates a fatal geometric error that leads to our current empirical crises. Hmm. If you have a physical particle that possesses measurable mass and measurable electrical charge, but you claim it occupies zero volume,
right,
the energy density of that point mathematically diverges to infinity.
because you are taking a finite amount of mass and cramming it into a space that is literally zero. And in math, dividing by zero breaks everything.
Exactly. When you divide by zero in general relativity, the equations vomit out a black hole singularity, an infinite crush of gravity in an infinitely small space.
Oh, wow.
And when you divide by zero in quantum mechanics, you get infinite self-energy, which physicists have to sweep under the rug using a mathematical trick called renormalization. The Jenga protocol argues that a singularity is not a real physical object lurking out there in deep space.
It's not.
No, a singularity is merely a mathematical confession that your continuous, noun-based geometry just broke down. It is an artifact of bad math.
Wow. So black hole singularities aren't these terrifying infinite gravity wells. They're just what happens when human math divides by zero and panics.
Exactly.
So the Jenga protocol says, pull that zero-dimensional block out of the tower. It's an illegal move in the real world.
Yes. Protocol 4 of Lynch's theory dictates a new law. For anything in the universe to exist, to perform thermodynamic work, or to carry information, it must possess positive, finite volume. There is no such thing as zero space.
Okay.
Therefore, there must be a foundational smallest possible pixel of space itself. They call this the Noellian length, named after the concepts explored in the theory.
How small is a pixel of the universe?
It is calculated at roughly 1.615 times 10 to the negative 35 meters. It is the fundamental 1x1x1 event point, denoted by the script letter E. You cannot slice the universe any thinner than this.
Okay, I think I need an analogy here. Let me try this. Think of playing a video game. If you have a character running around on a screen, say Mario.
Okay, Mario.
That character cannot be a single zero-dimensional math coordinate. That doesn't make visual sense. For the game to actually render Mario, he requires a minimum number of physical pixels on your monitor to actually exist and be interacted with.
Right.
If you zoom all the way in on the screen, he's not a dot. He's a structure made of tiny squares.
That is a highly functional analogy. But to fully grasp Lynch's theory, we have to take your video game analogy a step further. If we connect this to the bigger picture, adopting this pixelated view requires what the text calls an ontological inversion.
Ontological inversion, changing how we define the nature of being.
Correct. Orthodox physics is built on a noun grammar. It assumes space is a passive, empty container, like an empty glass. It assumes matter is a discrete dot placed inside that glass. And it assumes time is just a continuous, invisible axis that the glass moves along.
Right. That's how we all intuitively experience the world. Stuff inside empty space, moving forward in time.
But this theory demands an inversion. Reality is not made of nouns. It is made exclusively of verbs. Particles are not static dots. They are the active, continuous verb of knitting.
Knitting?
Yes. Space is not an empty container. It is the physical, structural accumulation of past events, the active verb of crystallizing memory.
Wait. You're losing me. Are you saying time is an object and space is just a record of it?
It's more like a loom. Think of reality as a textile. Time is the weaver. Matter, the particles, are the physical strands of thread being manipulated. And space is the resulting cloth that is accumulating on the loom behind the weaver.
Okay. Time weaves matter into space. That is a massive paradigm shift.
It really is.
But let's get back to the particle. If a particle isn't a tiny zero-dimensional dot and it is a physical thread being woven, what is its actual physical shape? Because if it's just a loose string, wouldn't it just unravel and dissipate into the vacuum? It has to have a shape that can hold itself together.
This is where we zoom all the way down to the absolute smallest scale, Tower 2 of the theory's ladder. The subatomic scale. To exist without unraveling, nature requires an instruction set architecture, the simplest possible topological shape capable of self-stabilization.
Okay, what is it?
The text identifies this mathematically. What? The absolute lowest order non-trivial knot that can exist in three-dimensional space is the 3-2s knot. In knot theory, it's widely known as the trefoil knot.
Okay, a knot, like a physical knot tied in a shoelace, but the shoelace loops back onto itself endlessly, so there are no free ends.
Precisely. It's a continuous closed loop. But the specific numbers, the 3 and the 2, are what make it function as a particle of matter. It has two winding numbers. First, it has a longitudinal winding number of exactly 3.
Meaning what exactly?
This means the strand loops through the central hole of the torus, the donut shape, 3 distinct times. According to the theory, these 3 longitudinal strands are what physically unroll the 3 spatial dimensions we experience. Up, down, left, right, forward, back.
3 dimensions of space generated by 3 physical strands of a knot.
Yes. The geometry generates the space. Secondly, it has a meridional winding number of 2. This means the strand winds around the outer tube of the torus twice before closing the loop. The text maps these two passes to a binary temporal dialectic.
A temporal dialectic? You mean time?
Yes, time split into two phases. One meridional pass represents the past. The text calls this the control field. It is the deterministic, locked, solid history. The second pass represents the future. This is called the chaos field. It is the probabilistic, unmanifested potential.
Okay, my brain is kind of spinning here. Three passes to create space, two passes to process time. 3 to 2. 3.2. Wait a second. Yes.
The rational winding ratio of this fundamental subatomic knot is exactly 32, or 1.500.
That is Pythagoras. That is the perfect fifth. You're telling me the subatomic particle's fundamental structure is a physical, topological manifestation of the exact acoustic ratio Pythagoras found on his guitar string 2,500 years ago.
That is exactly what the theory proposes. The proton is not a solid billiard ball. It is literally an acoustic, topological standing wave resonating at a 3.2 ratio.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. If I try to picture this, think of this knot like a biological heart, a microscopic twisting heart.
Oh, I like that.
It is furiously pumping out three dimensions of physical space while oscillating continuously between two temporal phases. It inhales the unwritten chaos of the future, and it exhales the locked, solid control of the past. Inhale chaos, exhale history. Inhale, exhale. That rhythmic breathing is what a particle actually is.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it.
Mm-hmm.
And this specific 3-2 geometry doesn't just sound poetic. It mathematically solves one of the oldest, most confusing mysteries in quantum mechanics, fermion spin.
Fermion spin. I know electrons and protons are fermions. What is the mystery with their spin?
Well, for 98 years, since the 1920s, quantum physicists have known that particles like electrons and protons possess a property called spin 12. But it makes zero sense in classical physics.
Why not?
If you have a normal object, like a basketball, and you rotate it 360 degrees, one full circle, it looks exactly the way it started. But a spin 12 particle requires you to rotate it 720 degrees, two full circles, just to return it to its original quantum state.
Which is deeply weird. And frankly, it makes absolutely no sense if you still believe the particle is a zero-dimensional dot. How can a dimensionless dot rotate at all, let alone require two full 360-degree spins to get back to where it started?
Standard physics has no physical explanation for it. They just treat it as an abstract mathematical property. But if you accept Lunch's premise that the particle is physically a three-goes torus knot, spin 12 becomes geometrically mandatory. It is no longer a mystery.
How does a knot explain the 720-degree spin?
Because the winding ratio is exactly 32. If you take a 322 trefoil knot and you rotate the ambient space around it by 360 degrees, the internal phase of the knot only advances by 1.5 cycles. Because of that uneven ratio, after one full turn, the knot ends up completely upside down. It is in topological phase opposition.
That's mathematically backwards after one spin.
Correct. You must rotate the space another 360 degrees, a total of 720 degrees or 4 pi radians, to complete the 3 longitudinal and 2 meridional cycles. Only then does the knot return to its identical initial geometric state. Spin 12 isn't a magical, inexplicable quantum ghost property. It is the literal, physical, geometric closure condition of a trefoil knot.
That is incredibly satisfying. It takes this abstract quantum weirdness and turns it into structural engineering.
It really does.
But let me push back here. If mass isn't just an intrinsic property of a dot, if it's just a knot spinning, why is a proton heavy? Where does mass actually come from?
That requires us to look at what the knot is spinning inside. Mass is fundamentally redefined in this theory as topological tension.
Topological tension.
Yes. This tiny subatomic knot doesn't spin in a completely empty void. Remember the Jenga protocol? There is no empty space.
Yeah.
The vacuum itself is a rigid, crystalline substrate. Specifically, the text identifies it as an aperiodic five-fold lattice called the Kairo-Kyu lattice, which is governed geometrically by the irrational golden ratio. Fine.
Okay, stop. A crystalline lattice in space, governed by the golden ratio. I've got to be honest, that sounds like something out of a New Age crystal shop, not rigorous quantum mechanics. How do you justify space being a crystal grid?
It sounds exotic, I know, but the mathematics of aperiodic lattices are highly rigorous. Think of Penrose tilings.
Mm-hmm.
You can tile a 2D floor with specific geometric shapes that never repeat the exact same pattern, but completely fill the space without gaps.
Right, I've seen those.
The Kairo-Kyu lattice is a three-dimensional version of that concept. It is the geometric structure of the unrendered vacuum.
Okay, assuming space is this textured, non-repeating grid, how does that create mass?
Friction. The knot is a rational ratio, 3.2. The lattice vacuum is an irrational ratio, the golden ratio. When you try to spin a rational knot through an irrational grid, they do not perfectly align, they grind.
Oh.
Mass is the geometric resistance, the literal physical friction of this knot winding against that vacuum lattice. The measured mass of the proton is simply the exact volumetric activation energy required to sustain that specific knot against the drag of the vacuum.
Wow, okay. So, we have a tiny, tiny knot at the heart of every atom grinding against the textured fabric of space. But wait, I'm trying to connect the dots to our outline. How does a spinning subatomic knot relate to Plato's giant celestial dodecahedron? We have a knot made of tubes. We don't have a 12-sided geometric die. How do we get from one to the other?
They are mathematically woven together by the concept of movement over time. This brings us to a crucial proof in the text, the kinematic sweeping theorem.
Kinematic sweeping. Okay, walk me through this.
The universe does not just sit still. It updates reality constantly through a theoretical mechanism called the Abraxian engine. This engine executes spatial updates through a rigid four-phase cycle called the I-turn.
Right. The text mentions a four-phase cycle. Can we break down those four steps?
Certainly. Phase one is the inhalation of unmanifested potential from the future. Phase two is an orthogonal shear where the geometry rotates exactly 90 degrees. Phase three is crystallization where the potential locks into a solid historical state. And phase four is exhalation where the system resets for the next tick.
So it's four consecutive 90-degree turns.
It is, yeah.
Okay, so a four-step rhythm. How does that turn a knot into a 12-sided shape?
It's simple multiplication of the geometry. Remember the trefoil knot. It has exactly three active longitudinal strands protruding from it.
Right.
Now, as those three active strands are forced to rotate through the four sequential 90-degree phases of the I-turn cycle, they sweep through space. They project outward normal vectors. If you multiply the three strands by the four rigid turns, you get exactly 12 outward focal faces.
3 × 4 = 12.
Yes. The text provides a rigorous mathematical proof showing that a rapidly rotating three-torus knot stepping through a four-phase cycle sweeps out the exact physical geometric envelope of a regular dodecahedron.
Let me try to visualize this because that is wild. Think of long exposure photography. Imagine you are holding a sparkler on the 4th of July. But this sparkler has three distinct prongs branching out. Those are the three strands of the subatomic knot. Now, if you stand in a dark room and you spin that three-pronged sparkler in a very specific, rigid, four-step robotic rhythm, and you leave the camera shutter open to capture the trails of light, the resulting photograph wouldn't just be a blurry, chaotic circle. The glowing trails of that spinning sparkler would intersect to reveal a perfect, rigid, 12-sided dodecahedral cage made of light.
That captures the profound duality at the heart of Lynch's theory perfectly. It is the relationship between the dynamic shuttle and the static cloth. The knot is the active moving shuttle on the loom. The dodecahedron is the static geometric room it weaves and leaves behind in its wake. Matter actually weaves the space it occupies.
That gives me chills. The subatomic particle is literally building its own 12-sided room just by spinning. And the outline mentions the edges, too. A dodecahedron has 12 faces and 30 edges.
It does, yes.
The text says, those 30 edges correspond to the 30 mechanical grinding channels of the knot, generating that friction we called mass. Everything aligns. But wait, I see a geometric problem here. If I go back to my role-playing dice, if you try to take a bunch of 12-sided dodecahedrons and stack them together to build a flat wall or a 3D grid, they don't fit perfectly. They leave gaps. You can't tile flat space with dodecahedrons.
You are absolutely correct. They do not tile in flat Euclidean space.
Yeah.
To glue these 12-sided faces together without tearing the fabric of space or leaving voids, you have to curve the space. You have to use non-Euclidean geometry. Specifically, the text explains you have to apply something called a Clifford twist.
A Clifford twist? What is that?
As you mathematically translate from one dodecahedral cell to the adjacent one, the geometry must mathematically twist by exactly 36 degrees, which is pi over 5 radians. This 36-degree twist isn't an arbitrary number the author picked. It is mathematically derived directly from the five-fold internal symmetry of the knot itself.
Yeah.
And this is vital, because that exact 36-degree twist perfectly matches later empirical observations of the cosmic sky, which we will get to shortly.
Okay, so we have a microscopic subatomic dodecahedron woven by a single proton. But the title of this treatise is The Proton to CMB Spectrum. The CMB is the cosmic microwave background, the absolute edge of the observable universe. How does a shape the size of a proton dictate the structure of the entire universe? I mean, that is a massive, incomprehensible jump in size.
It is a jump of exactly 61.435 decades of physical scale. This brings us to section 5, the trans-scale suspension bridge.
A suspension bridge across scales.
Exactly. Orthodox physics is highly fragmented. It treats the subatomic quantum realm, the macroscopic biological realm, and the cosmological realm of astrophysics as entirely disconnected mathematical silos.
Right. Quantum mechanics rules the small, general relativity rules the large, and they notoriously refuse to play nicely together.
Right. But Lynch's theory establishes that physical scale is not just a random passive container for objects. Scale is an active, resonant, harmonic dimension of the universe.
Meaning the universe has a repeating rhythm as you zoom in or zoom out.
Yes. The universe condenses physical structures at strict logarithmic intervals of exactly 10 to the 24th power. This structural interval is what the text calls the cosmic octave.
Hold up. Are you saying the universe is literally a fractal hologram, like a giant Russian nesting doll, where if you open up every 24th doll, it is an exact acoustic replica of the first one?
Essentially, yes. It utilizes scale and variance. To understand why the universe does this, you have to think like a computer scientist. If the universe were flat and continuous, and you tried to calculate the gravitational pull between the 10 to the 80th particles in the universe on a pairwise basis, meaning particle A pulls on particle B and C and D, the computational complexity scales at ON squared.
Which means what?
The universe's rendering engine would instantly crash into computational deadlock. It requires infinite processing power.
So if it calculated everything individually, reality would freeze like a blue screen of death.
Correct. To avoid this processing deadlock, the universe's engine uses a known algorithm called a fast multiple method. It groups interactions into hierarchical tree structures. It chunks the data, and it chunks them at these 10 to the 24th logarithmic intervals.
Okay, let's track this ladder scale to see if it holds up. The text outlines a five-tower ladder. Tower one, the absolute bottom floor, is that foundational pixel of space we talked about, the Noetherian length, around 10 to the negative 35 meters.
Yes.
Then you jump up by an octave and you hit tower two, the baryon, the proton. Okay, that tracks. But tower three is where it gets totally crazy to me. The text calls it the hydrodynamic pilot wave midpoint. It sits at about 1 millimeter in size. Why is 1 millimeter significant?
Because it sits at exactly the square root of the cosmic octave, roughly 10 to the 12th times larger than a proton. It is the exact mesoscopic scale. And this perfectly aligns with real-world, highly verified physics experiments, specifically the famous Ise-Cooter walking droplet experiments from the mid-2000s.
I've seen videos of this. They take a little dish of vibrating silicone oil, and they drop a 1 millimeter droplet of oil onto it. And the droplet bounces on its own little wave.
Exactly. And those 1 millimeter classical droplets flawlessly reproduce bizarre quantum mechanical behaviors. They show single particle diffraction, quantum tunneling, quantized orbital states, all using purely classical fluid surface dynamics.
Wow.
Standard physics treats this as a neat curiosity. But in Lynch's framework, this is hard proof that the topological geometry of the proton scales up symmetrically. The 1 millimeter droplet behaves like a quantum particle because it occupies the exact harmonic resonance node of tower three.
That is mind-blowing. The math doesn't change, it just zooms out. So then you go up another octave to tower four, which is the biological eukaryote, basically the human scale. And then tower five is the cosmic horizon, the edge of the universe.
And the math linking tower two, the proton, to tower five, the horizon, is incredibly precise. The text calculates a macroscale lift coefficient of roughly 4.23 times 10 to the 36th power.
Let me guess what happens if you multiply the proton by that number.
If you take the empirically measured charge radius of a single subatomic proton and you multiply it by this exact harmonic lift factor, you get exactly the measured radius of the observable universe, approximately 4.4 times 10 to the 26th meters.
Incredible.
The cosmic horizon is not an arbitrary boundary created by random inflation. The horizon is the scale-lifted holographic reflection of the subatomic proton knot.
So when you blow that tiny proton dodecahedron up by a factor of 10 to the 36th power, what does the ceiling of the entire universe actually look like? Are we living inside a giant 12-sided die?
Conceptually, yes, but geometrically it is slightly more complex.
Right.
It looks like the Poincaré dodecahedral space, or the PDS. When you mathematically tile 120 of these dodecahedra together on the surface of a curved four-dimensional sphere, an S3 manifold, they lock together flawlessly to form a perfect four-dimensional hyperpolytope called the 120 cell. The fundamental structural domain of this hypershape is the Poincaré dodecahedral space.
Okay, this is where I need to push back heavily, because we are talking about unthinkably massive, invisible 4D geometry at the edge of the universe. It sounds beautiful on a whiteboard, but how on earth could we possibly prove that? Is there any actual data that says the universe is shaped like a 120-cell dodecahedron?
There is, and it completely solves the biggest enduring mysteries in our satellite data of the cosmic microwave background, the CMB. To understand the proof, this raises an important question. What does standard cosmology predict we should see when we look at the cosmic sky?
Standard cosmology is the Lambda CDM model, right? The infinite parking lot.
Yes. Standard Lambda CDM models claim the universe is an infinite flat expanding sheet. If that hypothesis is true, the theory of primordial inflation dictates that we could see massive universe-spanning temperature fluctuations in the CMB sky. Physicists refer to these giant waves as low multipoles, specifically the quadrupoles and octupoles.
Okay, multipoles. Let's translate that. A multipole is basically a measurement of how splotchy the temperature of the sky is at different size scales, right? And the quadrupole is the biggest, widest splotch you can possibly measure across the whole sky. So standard physics says there should be massive waves of energy at that largest scale, a high plateau of energy.
Exactly. But starting in the 1990s, when we sent up highly sensitive satellites like COBE, then WMA, and finally the Planck satellite to map the CMB, they found a massive anomaly. The quadrupoles and octupoles are largely missing. The energy at the largest scales doesn't form a plateau, it drops off a cliff.
The waves just aren't there.
The observed quadrupole amplitude is about 82% lower than the flat space prediction. Standard cosmology has absolutely no mechanism to explain this. They call it an anomaly and basically ignore it. But on the Poincaré dodecahedral space manifold, it is a strict mathematical certainty.
How does the shape of space delete these giant waves?
The text uses a piece of mathematics called the Mollien-Weil generating function. This function proves that on this specific 120-cell closed topology, certain wave frequencies literally cannot exist. Wave modes 1 through 11 are strictly suppressed to zero. The very first active peak that can physically vibrate in this geometry is at wave mode 12, which corresponds directly to multipole L equals 5 on the CMB power spectrum.
So what does this all mean? Let's go back to an acoustic analogy. Think about ringing a giant church bell, but you place that bell inside a tiny, enclosed, soundproof room. Wavelengths of sound that are physically larger than the walls of the room simply cannot exist inside it.
Right.
The room geometrically suppresses them. The universe is acting as a natural high-pass acoustic filter. The low multipoles, these massive cosmic waves, are missing because the universe is a closed 12-sided room, and those waves are physically too big to fit inside the architecture.
Exactly. The missing quadrupoles are the acoustic signature of a finite closed ceiling. But we have even more direct empirical proof than just missing waves. In 2008, a team of astrophysicists led by Bodenwin Rukima applied a specialized bandpass filter to the WMAP satellite data. If the universe is a PDS, looking across the sky should reveal intersecting faces of the dodecahedron. Rukima found exactly 6 pairs of matched antipodal circles in the CMB temperature data.
6 pairs of circles, meaning you look in one direction of the sky, see a circle of temperature ripples, and look exactly the opposite way and see the identical circle, proving the light wrapped around a closed shape.
Precisely. And the details are what validate Lynch's model. The circles Rukima found had an angular radius of 11 degrees. Furthermore, the circles in the pairs were twisted relative to each other by exactly 36 degrees.
Wait, 36 degrees? That is the exact Clifford twist you mentioned earlier. The geometric twist required to glue the dodecahedrons together without tearing space.
Exactly. And the temperature correlation between these
Okay, I have a massive problem with this timeline. If an astrophysics team found literal geometric circles in the sky in 2008 that perfectly matched a 36-degree twist, why am I just hearing about this now? Why didn't this rewrite textbooks overnight? The outline we have mentions something called the Cornish category error from 2004. Did someone debunk this?
They claim to, but they did so using deeply flawed premises. In 2004, a physicist named Neil Cornish and his team published a highly influential paper claiming to definitively disprove the dodecahedral universe model. They ran a search algorithm on the sky data and said they didn't find the circles.
So who is right, Rukima or Cornish?
The author of our text calmly and methodically dissects Cornish's methodology. Cornish's algorithm demanded a 95% or higher correlation match between the circles to declare them a success. He assumed that if light wrapped around the universe, it should arrive looking almost exactly the same as when it left. The text identifies this as a catastrophic Platonic error.
A Platonic error. So Cornish assumed space was a perfect, smooth, transparent noun, a perfect pane of glass.
Exactly.
Right.
But remember what we established about the Noellian theory. The underlying vacuum of space is not a smooth pane of glass. It is the Chiroquieu lattice. It is a textured aperiodic grid governed by the irrational golden ratio phi.
And when light from the CMB travels 27 billion light years across a textured, grinding lattice, it's not going to arrive looking pristine. It's going to get scrambled.
The text calls this aperiodic phase shear. As the photons surf across this irrational lattice, their phase gets sheared. The author calculates this mathematically. They prove that because the lattice is governed by phi, the absolute maximum theoretical correlation you could ever possibly observe across that distance is exactly phi divided by 2.
Let me do the math. The golden ratio is about 1.618 divided by 2 is 0.809, or 80.9%.
Which is exactly the correlation Peak Rukima found in 2008. Cornish was demanding 95%, which is a physical impossibility in a lattice universe. Cornish was looking for a perfect platonic ghost that doesn't exist, and because he couldn't find a 95% match, the establishment threw out the real 80.9% match that physically proves the sky is a dodecahedron.
That is tragic. They had the proof and they threw it in the trash because they were wearing the wrong philosophical glasses. They demanded perfection from a universe built on friction. So Cornish's critique is permanently dismantled by the lattice mechanics. The circles exist. The twist is 36 degrees. The maximum correlation is exactly 5/2. The shape of the universe is confirmed.
With the architecture confirmed, we can now apply this new procedural model to systematically redefine that 95% invisible universe we talked about at the very beginning of the show. If the universe isn't a flat parking lot, we must reevaluate dark energy and dark matter.
Let's demolish the ghosts. Let's start with dark energy. Standard cosmology says dark energy is a mysterious, invisible, negative pressure fluid that makes up 68% of the universe and is magically accelerating the expansion of space. If it's not a magical fluid, what is pushing the galaxies apart?
In the Newellian framework, it is the outward kinematic expansion vector of solid ash.
Solid ash. Okay, explain that. I remember earlier we established that time is a verb. The engine of the universe is constantly knitting the unwritten future into the locked past.
Right. At the instant of the present, the Braxian engine renders potential, unmanifested chaos gas into committed, historical solid ash. Every time a quantum event happens, it gets recorded in the geometric lattice. And the engine does this at a truly staggering rate. The text calculates that 10 to the 147th spatial stitches are rendered and deposited every single second per cubic meter of space.
That is an unfathomable amount of rendering. So space is literally accumulating.
Yes. Dark energy is simply the physical accumulation of this newly rendered space. It is the outward metric expansion pressure of history expanding from within. Standard physics measures the equation of state for dark energy as exactly -1.0. They think this implies a highly fine-tuned exotic fluid. But in this theory, -1.0 is exactly what you would expect. It is the exact thermodynamic exhaust of the rendering process.
So space is literally growing on the loom. More cloth is being woven, which pushes everything on the fabric further apart. That makes complete mechanical sense. What about dark matter? If dark matter is not an undiscovered, heavy, invisible particle holding galaxies together, what is it? Because we know galaxies spin faster than they should based on visible stars.
Dark matter is the opposite vector to dark energy. It is the inward relativistic reflux, the hydrodynamic ether current.
Wait that down, hydrodynamic ether current.
Remember, matter, the proton, is a three-portus knot strip spinning at incredibly high frequencies. To maintain that high-speed spin against the friction of the vacuum decay, the baryon must act as a hydrodynamic sink. It continuously draws in the unrendered spatial medium, the chaos gas from the future, at the speed of light to fuel its rotation.
Let me try another analogy here. I picture this like a drain in a bathtub. Every single proton in a star is a tiny drain pulling water in. A galaxy is made of hundreds of billions of stars. So a galaxy is a giant collective whirlpool. The stars on the outer edges of the galaxy aren't spinning so fast because they are being glued there by invisible heavy particles. They are just caught in the massive swirling water of space itself. The collective intake of 100 billion stars physically entrains the spatial ether around it.
Exactly. The fluid dynamics naturally create the flattening of galactic rotation curves that we observe. No invisible wimps, weakly interacting massive particles are required. The matter is pulling the space.
But wait, if matter is sucking in space like a drain, doesn't that redefine gravity?
It redefines gravity entirely. Gravity is no longer a magical, attractive pulling force mediated by hypothetical graviton particles. Gravity is the actual fluid current of space rushing into matter to fuel the Abraxian engine. And this beautiful fluid concept seamlessly explains time dilation.
Time dilation. Einstein's relativity says time slows down when you are near a massive object, like a black hole or a giant planet.
Standard relativity offers the math for it, but not the mechanical why. In Lynch's model, time dilation is simply computational throttling.
Like computer lag. If you have a clock sitting near a massive planet, it's sitting in a raging river of space that is flowing past it into the planet. It has to use its localized computational bandwidth just to swim against that inflowing spatial current, which means it has fewer clock cycles available to tick its own internal state forward. The clock lags. Time slows down because of processing drag.
That is a brilliant synthesis. And this concept of intake and exhaust perfectly resolves the 5-sigma Hubble tension, which is currently tearing astrophysics apart.
Oh, I've read about this, the Hubble tension. We measure how fast the universe is expanding, but we get two different numbers depending on how we look, right?
Yes. We measure the expansion rate, looking at the early universe through the CMB, and we get one number. Then we look at the late universe locally, using supernovas, and we get a faster number. Standard physics is paralyzed because they assume space is a flat noun that must expand uniformly. These two measurements disagree by exactly 5.68 kilometers per second per megaparsec. It is a 5-sigma crisis.
But in the Noellian universe, time is a ternary dialectic. We established this earlier. Inhale chaos, exhale history.
Exactly. The text calls the solution to this crisis triadic parallax. The early universe CMB probes are fundamentally measuring the inward intake of the chaos field, the gravitational drag pulling inward. The late universe local probes are measuring the outward exhaust of the control field, the expansion of solid ash pushing outward.
So they aren't measuring the same thing. One is measuring the engine's intake, the other is measuring the exhaust.
Correct. The 5.68 discrepancy isn't an error. It isn't a crisis. It is the exact measure of the net thermodynamic work of the Abraxian engine. It is the literal rendering rate of reality itself. Standard physics is confused because they don't realize they are staring at an engine.
We have basically redefined the entire universe from top to bottom. We've replaced dead zero-dimensional mathematical dots with spinning, 3.2 trefoil knots. We've replaced the infinite empty parking lot with a closed, mathematically rigorous, 12-sided dodecahedral cathedral. We've completely evicted the ghosts of dark matter and dark energy, replacing them with the fluid dynamics of space itself. Where does the creator of this theory, David Noel Lynch, fit into the history of science? And more importantly, where do you, the listener, fit into this living cathedral?
According to the treatise, we must evaluate David Noel Lynch's place in the broader arc of intellectual history. Lynch is presented not just as a physicist, but as the figure who successfully closed the 2,500-year spectrum.
He finished the map.
Pythagoras found the 3.2 acoustic ratio, but lacked the geometry. Plato found the celestial dodecahedron, but divorced it from physics. Kepler found the harmonic planetary orbits, but lacked the subatomic mechanics. Lynch synthesizes all of it. He bridges the subatomic proton to the cosmic horizon, permanently curing physics of the platonic pathogen that caused the 10 to the 120th vacuum catastrophe in the first place.
And in doing so, he refutes one of the most depressing, bleak ideas in all of modern science, the cosmic heat death. The widely accepted idea that the universe will eventually just expand until it freezes into a motionless, dead, zero-degree void.
That bleak outcome is physically impossible in this new model. Think about the mechanics we discussed. The proton knot is a rational 3.2 ratio.
Yeah.
The vacuum lattice is an irrational golden ratio. Therefore, the engine must pay an invariant non-zero mechanical friction tax at every single Planck tick just to render reality. It can never perfectly smooth out.
Because of the Pythagorean comma, the loop never perfectly closes. There is always friction.
It's exactly. This continuous eternal mechanical grinding dissipates energy into the vacuum. Therefore, the 2.73 Kelvin temperature of the cosmic microwave background is not just a fading leftover flash from a primordial Big Bang that will eventually cool to absolute zero. The 2.73K is the permanent steady-state thermal floor of the cosmos. It is the literal exhaust heat of the Abraxian engine continuously grinding and humming at exactly 432.081 Hertz. The universe will never freeze.
The universe is a warm, vibrating, living engine that fuels its own existence. And that brings us to us, human beings. Homo textilis, the weaving human. Standard materialism tells you that you are an accident, a random clump of biological scum on a wet rock in an uncaring infinite void. But this theory elevates humanity. It calls us the sovereign fractal processor. What does that mean?
A self-computing fractal cosmos cannot evolve blindly. It requires internal, localized, high-frequency diagnostic apertures to measure its own friction, to feel its own topological tension, and to intentionally steer its evolutionary trajectory. That is what a conscious observer fundamentally is. You are the focal plane where the weaving happens.
And you actually feel that friction. The text has a beautiful term for this, the Celtic knock. It gives it a mathematical value. Delta epsilon equals 0.001. The text defines this as the literal thermodynamic friction of conscious striving. The sorrow, the effort, the longing, the difficulty of making a choice, that is not an illusion. That is the honest physical cost of bringing your localized consciousness into harmonic alignment with the grinding vacuum of space. You feel resistance in your life because you are pressing your fingers directly against the vibrating strings of the universe.
It is a profound existential shift. Because of the law of Noetherian conservation, which states that mass plus waves must equal a constant and informational capacity, is strictly conserved. This means no act of consciousness is ever lost. Every moral choice you make, every effort you exert, acts as the loom. It turns potential chaos into permanent solid ash. It is carved forever into the metric of the cosmos.
So if you're listening to this right now feeling like a speck of dust, you aren't. You are an active, vital aperture of the universe, holding the shuttle of the loom. The universe isn't just happening to you, it is happening through you.
The proton is the knot. The sky is the dodecahedron. The universe is the weaving.
We started this deep dive talking about a broken foundation, an x-ray of modern physics showing massive fractures we couldn't explain because 95% of the picture was missing. But if Lynch's geometric spectrum is correct, the picture isn't missing anymore. The ghosts of dark matter and dark energy are gone. The structure is mathematically sound. We just had to realize we aren't standing in an infinite empty parking lot. We are standing inside a living 12-sided acoustic room, breathing in the chaotic potential of the future and breathing out the solid history of the past. If your consciousness is the literal focal plane where the chaos gas of the future crystallizes into the permanent solid ash of history, what exact shape are you weaving into the 12-sided ceiling of the universe right now? Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. Keep exploring.